Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on this morning's magazine, advocates for Boulder's homeless community chalked up a win last night when Boulder City Council unanimously approved an extension of winter services. We'll get a report after headlines. Then we'll hear about the impact of the expansion of I-70 through downtown Denver on local communities who are dealing with environmental issues. Two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You, followed by Naturally with Brigitte Mars, will take us to the bottom of the hour. Then after headlines from the BBC, we'll get a commentary from Jim Hightower. And then we'll speak with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about what's happening with the faithless electors. Those are the electors here in Colorado and also in the state of Washington who wanted to cast their vote for somebody other than the person who won the vote in the 2016 presidential election. This was all in a bid to stop Donald Trump from becoming the president. Well, last week, the Supreme Court said it would hear the case. We'll catch up with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig on the impact of this and the potential impact on the 2020 elections. At 9 o'clock, we'll get an update on what's happening with the municipalisation process here in the city of Boulder. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Colorado senators differed in their votes yesterday on whether to subpoena documents and witnesses in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Democrat Michael Bennett, who is also a candidate for president, voted with the rest of the Democrats in the Senate minority to issue subpoenas to the White House, the State Department, and other agencies related to the Ukraine scandal. Bennett also supported issuing a subpoena to White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Republican Senator Cory Gardner, who is running for re-election this November, voted with the GOP to table and effectively kill subpoenas for documents and witnesses. As Bennett and Gardner sat in the Senate chamber, Representative Jason Crow, Democrat of Aurora, acted as one of the House managers prosecuting the case against the president. He argued in what turned out to be a losing effort to issue a subpoena for documents from the Office of Management and Budget. Crow said that they know documents exist and the only reason they don't have them is because the president directed the agency not to release them. The fight over whether to have documents and witnesses in the trial of the president came, as we heard on Democracy Now!, with the Senate voting along party lines to conduct the proceeding on rules drafted by Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The trial of President Trump continues today. A Denver-based oil and gas company has agreed to pay $3.5 million to settle claims that it violated laws designed to minimize air pollution. K.P. Kaufman, the oil and gas company, entered into the settlement after an investigation by the Environmental Protection Agency and the state officials found elevated levels of hazardous emissions from storage tanks between 2013 and 2018. Leaks of chemicals called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, have been a focus of concern for air pollution officials. The Denver Post reports that the pollution leads to the formation of ground-level ozone that irritates lungs, exacerbates asthma, and increases susceptibility to respiratory illnesses. K.P. Kaufman will be required to spend $2.5 million on pollution controls on the nearly 70 facilities it operates in Colorado. The settlement comes in a case filed against the company in federal court in 2018, alleging that it failed to adequately minimize emissions from its operations in parts of Colorado that have been designated as ozone non-attainment areas. A release from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment says that the agreement with K.P. Kaufman is the agency's 10th settlement resulting from its investigation. The settlement also requires the company to conduct more frequent inspections and to respond promptly to observed VOC emissions. Meanwhile, the CDPHE posted an alert lasting until 4 p.m. today, warning that air quality in the 7-county metropolitan area is expected to reach unhealthy levels for sensitive people. The air is expected to improve today and return to the moderate category. Lawmakers at the state capitol are expected to introduce a bill this week that would restrict the sale to and use by consumers of certain pesticides that take a toll on honeybees and other pollinators. The Pollinator Protection Act would restrict the sale of neonicotinoids and sulfoxaflor to consumers. It would put them on the state's restricted use pesticide list. One of the sponsors of the bill, Representative Sonia Jaquez-Lewis, a Democrat from Boulder County, told the Daily Camera that we have to do something to save the bees, because if we don't have bees, we don't have food. The bill would exempt licensed applicators, including landscapers and commercial users. It would also exempt farmers and some other private applicators. Hakaz Lewis acknowledged that the bill is not as far-reaching as some would wish, but she said it's a great first step. The advocacy organization Environment Colorado is backing the bill, citing statistics that show Colorado has more than 900 bee species and a 23% loss of colonies for the state's beekeepers in the early months of 2018. The bill is also supported by the Sierra Club and by the City of Boulder, which has banned the use of neonicotinoids on city properties since 2015. Lawmakers are also expected to introduce a bill establishing a public health insurance option. A new poll shows that nearly 60% of those surveyed favored the public option. The poll conducted by Strategies 360 showed particularly strong support on the Western Slope, where residents have struggled with some of the highest health care costs in the country. As envisioned, a public option health insurance option would be sold by private companies, but would be overseen by the Colorado Division of Insurance and the Department of Health Care Policy and Financing. Lawmakers are expected to introduce a public option bill soon. Senator Carrie Donovan, a Democrat from Vail and one of the sponsors of the proposed bill, told the Denver Post that she was not surprised at the poll results, as it reflects what she has heard in her district, which she describes as a rural and conservative part of Colorado. Today's weather will see breezy and at times gusty conditions under partly sunny skies and a high of 47. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 40s. Right now, it's about 43. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. Boulder City Council came down on the side of those experiencing homelessness last night by voting to keep the city's severe weather shelter open for an extended period this winter. KGNU's Ros Brown has more on the unanimous vote.
Boulder will keep its severe weather shelter serving those who are homeless open until March 31st this year. The unanimous vote is a partial victory for homeless advocates who have long argued that Boulder's severe weather shelter does not maintain adequate hours of operation. Councilmember Aaron Brockett pushed for council to approve additional funds last year, but could not win support from fellow council members. He made his pitch a second time last night.
To keep severe weather shelter open nightly through the end of March this year, and then to incorporate in our planning for the next version of severe weather shelter next season, dates of November 15th to the end of March, subject to analysis on how it worked for the rest of this season and other ideas people have from a policy perspective to be determined later.
The severe weather shelter would also open during April and May should the temperature drop below 32 degrees. The facility is operated by The Bridge House, a local organization that provides homeless services and programs. CEO Isabel McDevitt told council the organization could handle the additional days of operation, but warned it cannot sustain every person experiencing homelessness in a sheltering model.
One of the things that we did see last year with severe weather shelter is that over 30% of people using severe weather shelter on a regular basis are some of our most chronic known folks who have been screened already. And so the night someone walks in for shelter, we should be talking about what's their exit. Shelter is not a solution unto itself.
Since adopting a housing first strategy, rather than focusing on emergency services for the homeless, Boulder has placed a couple hundred people into permanent housing. Mayor Sam Weaver suggested the city needs to find a balance between emergency services and permanent housing for the homeless.
We don't want people exposed to the threat of hypothermia and frostbite on our streets. And so that's the reason to do this. We have to be careful that it doesn't detract from the housing-focused shelter work, because we placed a record number of people from homelessness into housing this year. We should celebrate that. It's not enough, but it is taking the folks who are chronically homeless in Boulder and getting them into permanent shelter, and housing is the solution to homelessness. So whatever we do with making sure that people don't become harmed on our streets through this shelter program, we need to make sure that we keep focused on the people who are long-term homeless in Boulder.
A permanent fix to homelessness was discussed at length last weekend as part of City Council's annual retreat. Ideas include possible campgrounds and a parking area where people could stay in their vehicles overnight without being chased off by police. Those issues will be discussed further at an April study session. Councilman Adam Swetlik, who made solving homelessness a key point of his election campaign last year, said a holistic approach is needed to make sure all ideas are considered.
I just wanted to reassert that this is very much what we did tonight is just the floor of things that need doing, that this is a very broad and deep issue, and it's going to take a very, very comprehensive set of different things to address it in the way that it needs to be addressed.
The annual point in time count of those experiencing homelessness, both sheltered and unsheltered, is scheduled for next Monday, January 27th. During last year's count, more than 600 people were identified as homeless in Boulder County. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
You can find all of our coverage on this issue around how the city of Boulder is dealing with homelessness. It's all online at news.kgnu.org, as is all of our coverage from Boulder City Council. It is just coming up on 15 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. Well, for the past few years, KGNU has been working with students in the Environmental Studies program at CU Boulder in partnership with the Just Transition Collaborative on a series that's called The Brink. It's a radio storytelling project about what is needed to transition to a more just environment and society. And it tells stories of inequality, struggle and transformation. Over the next few days, we're going to hear some stories that have been produced recently by students. Today, we're going to hear a story called History Repeating Itself. Illyria Swansea endures major hits due to the expansion of I-70. In North Denver, crews are working on an overhaul of I-70. It's being billed by the Department of Transportation as the Central 70 Project. Well, this project replaces a viaduct with a tunnel for the highway, which is currently being excavated through the neighbourhood of Illyria Swansea. And it's known to have very polluted soil, as evidenced by numerous Superfund sites in the area over the past few years. Well, CDOT's practices and the impact of the project seems to disproportionately impact poorer, primarily Latinx communities. And this has made the I-70 expansion a contentious issue for many in the area. We'll hear this report next, produced by Michael Sparkman, Juliana Finelli and Benjamin Eli Wigod-Morse.
What you're hearing is the sound of the recently started I-70 expansion project in North Denver. Here at 47th and York in Illyria, Swansea, residents of the nearby houses in the predominantly Latinx neighborhood have been hearing this on a regular basis as crews work to excavate a tunnel where there is now a viaduct for the highway.
We heard from Mary Hernandez about her experiences as a longtime resident of the area who lived in Illyria, Swansea when the viaduct was first built in the 1960s.
And my neighborhood was tore down, and a lot of digging and a lot of noise, and it affected my family tremendously.
Illyria Swansea is in one of the most polluted zip codes in the nation, and the area surrounding the viaduct has been shown to have high levels of arsenic, lead, and other toxins in the soil. Exposure to these newly excavated toxins increases the risk of certain health issues, including asthma, reproductive and endocrine issues, cancer, anxiety, and depression. All of which and more have impacted Mary Hernandez's family and many others.
Here, so this is a giant dust storm. This is the highway. This is the Denver Coliseum, and it's super windy. It's probably like 50 mile an hour gusts, and it's dust is blowing all over the place. And this is all of the they're digging the trench right now through these old smelter sites. So all this dust is cadmium, arsenic, lead.
That was Brad Evans, founder of the local opposition group Ditch the Ditch, describing a video he captured of dust at the worksite being picked up by gusts of wind. Given the risks that this project poses to the community, you may wonder why it has continued to this point. Although many in the community have opposed the project for years, the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT, has continued to push forward. We spoke with Denver City Councilwoman Candy C. DeBaca, who was able to comment on CDOT's alleged practices in buying property from local homeowners to be demolished in order to make room for the tunnel. These alleged practices include intimidation tactics targeted towards residents' perceived documentation status.
I've seen this type of thing happen, and CDOT calls it informing them, you know, for them to let someone who's undocumented know that there's no mitigation for them, because they're not a person under our federal laws that govern relocation.
We have received similar reports from several community members. Stacia Sellers, a spokeswoman for CDOT, said this in response to these claims of intimidation tactics, including threats to call ICE.
That is entirely inaccurate. And for ICE, CDOT has... it's inaccurate.
She also had this to say.
You know, we always encourage people, if they have issues with the project, to call our hotline number, and we put that into our own documentation, and that information isn't getting dispersed anywhere, and we never ask for citizenship.
Whether or not CDOT is using these tactics, the North Denver community has a lot to lose from this project. Councilwoman Sita Baca, a fifth-generation native of Elyria Swansea, had this to say.
It's really just the new iteration of how it happened in the first place. Bulldozing communities of color, communities living in poverty, and doing so with under the auspices of alleviating congestion, when we know that congestion is not going to be alleviated by this expansion.
Many community members who are still fighting to have this project stopped are doing so because of the effect that it could have on them and future generations. Mary Hernandez sees history repeating itself in the new I-70 project and does not want to see other families experience what her family has.
Because I see my family suffer every day, because I'm in and out of hospitals, because I see my two blind granddaughters every day struggling to live, just my whole family just struggling daily. It takes a toll. It takes a toll. Some nights I don't sleep.
That story was produced by CU students Michael Sparkman, Juliana Finelli, and Benjamin Eli Wigod-Morse, and they're part of the Environmental Studies Program at CU Boulder. That's part of The Brink, which is a series done in partnership with the students, KGNU, and the Just Transition Collaborative. We're going to be hearing more of these stories over the coming days. Tomorrow, we're going to hear about what happens when we get those ozone alerts. If you're in that sensitive category, the CDPHE, in fact, posted an alert that lasts until 4 p.m. today, warning that air quality in the metro area is expected to reach unhealthy levels for sensitive people. Well, we're going to hear the voice of one of those people who are considered to be sensitive to ozone and the impact of air quality on them. And that will be on tomorrow's Morning Magazine as part of this series, The Brink. It is 8:22 and it's time now for Make Them Hear You.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Virginia just ratified the 1972 Equal Rights Amendment. Both houses of Virginia's legislature voted to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, but the ERA's future is uncertain. Its original deadline lapsed decades ago. Virginia became the pivotal 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment after its Senate and House of Delegates voted Wednesday to approve the change to the U.S. Constitution. The ERA's provisions include a guarantee that, quote, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Virginia Senate voted 28-12 and the House of Delegates 59-41 to approve the ERA. The ratification vote came after voters put a record number of women in office in November. The State House now has the first female speaker in its history. Quote, the people of Virginia spoke last November, voting a record number of women into the House of Delegates and asking us to ratify the ERA, said House Majority Leader Charnel Herring. Quote, it's inspiring to see the amendment finally be considered, voted on, and passed. Long-awaited recognition that women deserve, close quote. Congress approved the ERA in 1972, set a ratification deadline of 1979, and then extended that to 1982. Indiana became the 35th state to ratify the amendment in 1977, leaving it three states shy of the threshold, and their thing stalled. That changed in recent years as advocates mounted a new push. Nevada ratified the ERA in 2017. Illinois followed suit a year later. Now, there are differing legal opinions about whether the ERA has missed its chance to become the law of the land. Advocates say Congress could simply set a new deadline and refresh the expired time frame, but some of the states have revoked their support of the ERA, and Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel posted an opinion this month stating, quote, the ERA resolution has expired and is no longer pending before the states. The matter will likely be settled in court, particularly after three states, Alabama, Louisiana, and South Dakota, filed a lawsuit last month seeking to block the archivist of the United States from adding the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. Democrats in the House announced initial steps Friday to try to revive the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, breathing new life into a fight that most thought had been dead for decades. It's led by Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler, who says he's written legislation to repeal the time limit written into the original ERA, giving states a new chance to ratify it. If you have an opinion on the Equal Rights Amendment and attempts to revive it in Congress, you can contact your senators and representative. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And it's time now for Naturally.
Greetings, welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars talking about foods for sexual vitality. The word aphrodisiac derives from the name Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, fruitfulness, and beauty. Are there such things as aphrodisiacs? Well, in general, we could look at foods that either have a suggestive shape that make you think of something sexy, like maybe a banana or a mushroom or an oyster, or maybe it's so super nourishing that it gives you amazing energy, or maybe it relaxes you, or maybe it's something that is designed to attract pollinators like edible flowers. So, what are some of those foods? Because, you know, every meal we make a decision. Well, artichokes are actually the unopened flower bud of a member of the sunflower or daisy family, close relative of dandelion and thistle and sunflower, all plants of the sun. So it can be very emotionally beautiful to share something with your beloved, like to share an artichoke and dip into the same wonderful sauce, for example. But artichokes are nourishing to the fluids of the body, and they are just one of those many foods. We could certainly think of asparagus, and many of us have noticed the smell of asparagine in our urine afterwards. So asparagus actually stimulates circulation to the genitourinary tract. Eat some of those in a sensual way with your beloved. You can pick them up with your fingers. That is totally okay. Avocados are a great food for containing lecithin. And lecithin is a component of not only the myelin nerve sheath of our nervous system, but also of our sexual fluids. You know, the ancient Aztecs call avocado awactal, which means testicle tree. In general, when we're thinking about libido, we want to think about eating foods that are super nourishing and actually stimulate circulation to our lower centers. So certainly we have root vegetables, things like sweet potatoes and carrots and burdock root. Yeah, I like to make a dish called Roots Rock Reggae. Now, you're probably not going to find this in the average store, unless you go to an Asian market or maybe if you're having a vacation, but durian is a member of the durian family. It's a really large fruit, and there's a saying in Malaysia, when the durians fall, the sarongs rise. So think about that. You might just want to get a durian and share with your beloved or a few friends. They're very high in sulfur. Last thing is figs. When we're eating figs, we're actually eating the seeds. I hope you bring some Loving Potions to your table. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
Lots more to come here at KGNU this morning. Coming up at 8:35, we'll hear from Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. He is supporting the so-called faithless electors. They rather call themselves Hamilton electors, and they have chosen to, well, they chose back in 2016 not to cast their vote for the person who won the popular vote in Colorado and also in the state of Washington. Now, that was Hillary Clinton here in Colorado, but they were trying to cast their vote for somebody else. This was all in an effort to stop Donald Trump from becoming the president. Now, last Friday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case brought by one of the faithless electors here in Colorado and also a similar case in Washington State. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig has been supporting those electors, and he will support them through this Supreme Court hearing. It's expected to be heard in April, with a decision maybe coming down in June. So it could really impact the 2020 election. We'll hear more from Lawrence Lessig on that case, but also on this broader issue of the Electoral College system, money in our elections and gerrymandering as we are in an important election year. That's coming up at 8:35. Now, coming up tomorrow morning, just after 8:30, we're going to kick off a year of special coverage on food waste with a special extended Radio Nibbles. John Lendorf will join us live in the studio with a special guest, a local chef who'll be demonstrating some knife skills. Yes, you heard it right, live on the radio. And it's all with a view to educating us on food prep techniques that will help eliminate how much food we actually waste in the kitchen. So tune in for that. It's just after 8:30 tomorrow morning.